Mr. Grant Taft, at age 25, was the youngest coach in America at McMurray State. Went to Baylor in 1972, took a program, was voted the conference coach of the year with a 6-5 record. Then last year, the impossible dream came true. First time in 52 years, Baylor won a conference championship, went to the Cotton Bowl, and in their brochure it said one of his main reasons for his success, he's a coach who cares. Duffy Doherty mentioned to us yesterday that he is the finest clinic speaker he's ever heard in his life, and I thought that was quite a compliment. Grant Taft.
First of all, let me say that it is an honor to be asked to share a podium with you and give you some of my thoughts and my philosophies and my ideas. And let me make it very, very clear to you at the outset that I'm not an expert in anything, not in anything. I'm going to speak to you this morning on motivation, but I want to make it very clear to you that I'm not an expert on motivation. But there are some thoughts and some beliefs and some philosophies that we adhere to that might be usable in your own life and in the young men's lives that you work with. Let me say that being the National Coach of the Year was one of the great thrills of my life. I guess every coach would aspire to be by his peers selected as the Coach of the Year. And I humbly accepted that great honor. And I think it probably meant more to me than maybe anybody that's ever gotten it. I couldn't speak for everyone, but I know it meant an awful lot to me. Because if you have been in coaching long enough, you're going to have been in the valley and hopefully get to the mountaintop. And I've been in the valley many, many times, as you have been, and I'm sure I will be again. But to experience the mountaintop has been a great pleasure. And I hope that in some way, those of you that love coaching and strive in your everyday life and in your work to attain the top in the profession, to be recognized by your peers. I hope that you know and understand that by Grant Taft being selected, that simply means that anybody in this country is capable of attaining that lofty position. And I'm so very happy that our university shared in it with me. Now, in sharing knowledge and experience and philosophies, it is so important that the ear of the beholder be attuned properly. Yes, I said the ear of the beholder. You know, like in viewing some great painting, they say, well, it's all in the eye of the beholder. Well, in a clinic, it is your ear that counts and your receptiveness and your openness to what's being said. So let me say to you that though many points may be made, they will only be valid if they are acceptable to you and to your philosophy. Duffy Doherty has stole one of my jokes I was going to tell you. I heard that he told you about the Christian bear, so I'm not going to tell you that. But I would like to share something with you that I believe in very strongly. I have a philosophy that I don't believe that there's any place in human life for alcohol. Now, I know that a lot of folks disagree with that, and I know a lot of coaches disagree with that, and that's fine, you know, because it really doesn't bother me what your philosophies are. I'm just telling you what mine are. And when I became a head coach at 25 years of age, I tried to share every bit of my philosophy all at one time with the guys. You know, I just heaped it on them, just piled it on top of them, everything I believed, everything that I wanted to get across as a coach. And that summer, prior to my first season as a head coach, I decided that without question, I was going to impress upon their young lives what alcohol would do to their body physically. So I contrived a demonstration that would, without question, show them exactly what alcohol would do to them. They reported to the campus, about 75 of them. We were ready for them. One of my coaches met them, invited them into a meeting room, had all the paraphernalia ready. Didn't even issue any equipment or let them go to the dorm. Came right into the meeting room. One of the assistants said, listen, Coach Taft has something very important he wants to share with you today, and here's Coach Taft. I walked to the center of the room behind the podium very dramatically and looked them in the eye, and I said, now listen, fellas, there's something that's on my heart that I want to share with you. I believe there's no place in human life for alcohol, and the way I want to try to get it across to you is by a demonstration. I believe you can notice and recognize in a demonstration what alcohol will do to your body, and therefore I'm going to give you this demonstration that I've worked on all summer. I reached underneath the podium, pulled out a beaker. I said, fellas, in this beaker right here is 100 proof grain alcohol. And in this beaker right here, pure tap water. And in this little box right here, fellows, I have two earthworms from the flower bed outside. Now, you fellows watch closely as I drop this worm in the beaker of alcohol, and I dropped him in, and he literally shriveled and died before their very eyes. I was so pleased about that. I said, now, fellas, watch closely as I drop this worm in the beaker of water, and I did, and he just swam over at the edge up on the side of the beaker and fell off on the table. Dramatically, as I knew how, I stepped back and I said, now, fellas, savor for just a moment what this demonstration has meant to you. Think about it. Make application to your own individual lives. Now I'm going to call on Carl Dunn, our starting defensive tackle, to stand and relate to the other members of this squad what this demonstration has meant to him. Carl, won't you stand? Carl was 6'6", weighed about 255 pounds. I thought it was going to take him all day to get up out of the chair. I wanted him to get up and tell me about it. He finally got up, cocked his hip, put his hand on it, leaned over on the chair in front of him, said, Coach, I want to tell you, there's the finest experiment I've ever seen in my life. And I'll tell you, you have duly impressed me today and all my teammates because I can tell the way that's paying attention. He said, fine, Carl, just tell me what this demonstration has meant to you personally. Well, Coach, I guarantee you, you hit home today. You hit right between the eyes. You made a point there that really hit home. I said, fine, just tell me what the demonstration meant to you. Well, Coach, here it is. Now, you fellas check me out and see if it's not right. What you're saying to us fellas, Coach, is simply this. That if a fella drinks lots of that there alcohol, he won't never have none of them worms. It's all in the ear of the beholder. It's just how you want to listen to things. It's how you want to understand them. There's some people that have the capacity and ability to get across a message in very few words, you know. I'm not one of these guys. It takes me a long time. I have to beat around the bush. But I'm a Baptist, and we have a lot of Baptists in our part of the country. And Baptist preachers are the world's worst for, you know, they have great messages. But, man, it takes them till 12:15 on Sunday, and I'm ready to get out of there. But I knew this fellow in the city of Abilene, where I used to coach, that had that capacity, the ability to get across a message in few words. Something else. He was 89 years old, still an active preacher. Every day he'd leave the little parsonage and go down to the church. Every morning, 7 o'clock, no matter what the weather conditions outside, every morning, down to the church, active, fantastic preacher, ability to get across a message in few words. Had a hard time seeing, hard time moving. He's old. He got to the street this morning to get across the street. Truck bypass there, and he always looked to the right carefully, looked to the left, and 7 o'clock in the morning weaved his way through the traffic. Well, this particular morning, he looked to the right, didn't see anything, looked to his left, started across the road, and he saw something beside the road. He moved up, get a little better look. It's a dead mule. Gotten out of the livestock auction barn, was struck by a truck, and was killed there beside the road. Now, he's very civic-minded. Understanding the early morning traffic, he said to himself, that's going to be a hazard, the early morning traffic. So he carefully made his way across the street, watching the traffic. Didn't move too rapidly. Over to the service station, there's a pay telephone outside the service station. He walks up, drops a dime in it, and dials the city sanitation department number. Now, 7 o'clock in the morning. Hello, city sanitation department. Son, this is Brother Eli Jones. I'm pastor of the Macedonia Baptist Church. There's a mule down here on the highway, and it's dead. And it's your duty and your responsibility to remove the body so that it will not be a hazard to the early morning traffic. Hey, did you say this was a preacher? Son, I am the pastor of the Macedonia Baptist Church. My name is Brother Eli Jones, and I say to you that there's a mule on this road, graveyard dead. It's your duty and your responsibility, and yes, your obligation to remove the carcass. Did you say this was a preacher? Son, for the third time, I am the pastor of the Macedonia Baptist Church. Oh, the mule's body must be removed, and you should do it. Oh, I thought you preachers were supposed to take care of the dead. Sort of floored my old friend for just a moment. Then he came with that unique capacity and ability to deliver a message in a few words. He thought and he said, son, it is true that we preachers are supposed to take care of the dead. And we do. And oh, I will, but one of our very first, and yes, our most solemn duty, is to notify the next of kin. Well, now, if the old boy at the city sanitation department hadn't been paying real close attention, he might have missed a point that my old friend was trying to make. So you pay close attention. Let me try to make two or three points to you that I think are important. Let me make one that I feel very important. I want to see how you respond to it and how you react to it. It has to do with motivation, but it's not a part of the motivation talk that I want to give you. It is simply that I believe with all my heart that one of the greatest commodities, one of the greatest characteristics of human life is loyalty. Loyalty. I wouldn't have a man on my coaching staff that is not totally loyal to me, to the program, or to my school. I just wouldn't have one. Loyalty is the most important thing in America. You tell me that America would be where we are today without loyal and dedicated men and women. How in the world could we be in a building like this with the opportunity of freedom to coach, to live, to act, and to breathe without men and women that were loyal and dedicated? I just tell you, it couldn't happen. In your business, in your family, in your school, or in your life, if you do not have the capacity for loyalty, you're a loser, and you'll always be a loser. You find me a man that has loyalty and dedication, and I'll show you a winner. When I first went to Baylor University, everybody said, hey, that's a loser. There's no way, coach. You're throwing away a good career to go there. There's no way you can win. But I believe we could. And I took the job, and I had a phone call the second day after I took the job. Young man from Grand Prairie, Texas. He was a head coach in Grand Prairie. Very successful. He said, Coach Staff, could I come down and talk to you? I said, sure. He came down, walked into my office, sat down. I said, Bill, his name's Bill Young. I said, Bill, what can I do for you? He said, Coach Staff, I want to join you at Baylor University. I believe in you, and I believe what you're doing, and I want to be a part of it. I have total dedication and loyalty to you. Though I've never worked with you, I don't know you well, I have watched you, and I believe you're going to get the job done, and I want to help you do it. I'll tell you one thing, that impressed me. The young man was dedicated. He was a successful coach. He believed in me. He believed in what we were trying to do, and I hired him. He became my offensive line coach, and I'll tell you today, he's the finest offensive line coach in America, bar none. You can't show me a better one. Now he is my offensive coordinator at Baylor University and one of the most successful in the nation. But he is the most loyal and dedicated individual I've ever known to my school, to me, and to our program. It's not a yes group. We don't agree on everything. We get in that staff meeting and the fur flies, baby. But I guarantee you when we walk out that door, we're 140% together on what we agreed on, and nothing varies or nothing deviates from that point. Loyalty, dedication. 1973, our second year at Baylor University. For whatever reason, it doesn't. 1973. And I've never hurt as bad, and I've never suffered. And you talk about the valley, I was there. Right before Christmas, knock on my door at my office. I look up, and it's Bill Young. Walks in, he pulls the door behind him. Well, I knew it was something serious. I said, Bill, what is it? He said, Coach Staff, I want to talk to you very seriously about something. I said, fine. I said, listen, you have got to get out of this office. You've gone through heck this last year. You're working night and day. We've been through recruiting season. You're completely worn out. You're exhausted. And if you don't get out of this office, you're going to kill yourself. And I'm telling you right now, I want you to take care of yourself, and I want you to get out of this office. I said, Bill, I don't have time to get out of the office. I've got too many things to do. He said, you're getting out of the office. I said, I'm not going to do it. He said, you're getting out of the office. I'm going to see to it that you get out of the office. Let's go deer hunting. Well, let's get away. We'll take a couple of days. We'll go down South Texas. We'll just get out and we'll deer hunt. I said, Bill, you are driving me crazy. I don't have time to do that. He said, you have got to get out of this office. I said, you drive the hardest bar. I tell you what I'll do. I'll compromise with you. I'll go one day and we'll leave in the morning, come back that night, and I'll get out of the office with you. He said, that beats nothing. Let's go in the morning. I said, fine, Bill, where are we going to go? He said, oh, I don't know. I thought maybe you knew a good place. Well, I said, there's a fellow that called me in 1972 and invited us to go deer hunting up his place. It's 25 miles north of Waco, Texas, Meridian, Texas. Up in the hills, a lot of trees, and a lot of deer. I said, let's just drive up there in the morning. We'll ask the guy if he'll let us day hunt. We'll just go out and hunt on his place. Bill said, great. He came by my house the next morning. We got in the car, put our guns in. I want to tell you how I felt about Bill Young. In 1973, when we were 2 and 9, there are not many folks in that old country down there that I would have gotten in a car with a loaded gun. But I liked old Bill. I liked old Bill. Well, we start driving out toward Meridian. We're sickling along out there, the windows down, the cool breeze in our face. We're relaxing. Everything's feeling good. We're talking and just reminiscing, having a great time, talking about next year. And all of a sudden, I'm feeling better. We get about 10 miles out of Meridian. There's a dirt road. We turn off to the left. Gravel road dust flies up behind us 15 more miles. Pull up in front of a ranch house, pull up to the gate. wooden gate, barbed wire fence, 30 yards behind the gate, it's a little ranch house. I said, Bill, wait here. I'll get out and go see if the gentleman will let us hunt. I walk up, walk across the wooden porch, knock on the screen door, and I hear inside coming toward me the sound of boots walking on a wooden floor. So the rancher, he comes to the door, opens the screen door, steps outside, and he recognized me and said, my Lord, Coach Steph, what in the world are you doing out here? I said, I just came out to see you, and you said in 1972, if I ever wanted to go hunting out here on your place, that you'd let me, and one of my coaches, we just decided to drive out here and see if you'd let us hunt. Oh, Coach Steph, anytime, I'm so happy to have you out here, and I want to tell you something, Coach Steph. You guys did the finest job at Baylor University this year. I know you didn't win all those games, but you're laying a foundation, and I'm so proud of you. I support that university in every way, and anytime you want to come out here, I'm just so thankful to have you. I said, man, that's so nice of you, and I appreciate it very much. And we'll be very careful, and we just want to spend the day out here. So I started to walk off the porch, and he said, Coach Staff, could I see you just a minute? I said, well, sure. He said, listen, I hate to ask you to do this, but I'm going to anyway. It's something that's really troubling me, and I'm just going to ask you if you'd do it for me. I said, well, certainly. He said, you see that barn out there? I said, yeah, I see the barn. He said, you see that old mule beside the barn? I said, yeah, I see the mule. He said, listen, that mule's been with me for 25 years. I love it like a member of my family. It's diseased. It's sick. It's old. It needs to be destroyed. And I just don't have the heart to do it. Would you shoot that mule for me? I said, listen, man, I'd rather not. You know, I just really don't care to shoot your mule. He said, I'd appreciate it. I said, well, you've been most gracious to us, and I hate to do it, but I will. He said, thank you so much. We went back in the house. I walked off the porch out through the yard, opened the gate, swung it closed behind me, walked up the car, and just about the time I got about 3 yards from the car, this impulse hit me. I set my jaw, let my lower lip start quivering a little bit, squinted my eyes and gritted my teeth. Swung open the door and just plopped down in the seat. Bill looked at me and said, what's the matter, Coach? I said, that old man wouldn't let us hunt out here, Bill. He wouldn't? I said, no, he dang sure wouldn't. Besides that, Bill, you ought to heard what he said to me. What did he say? He said I was the sorriest football coach that God ever let live on this planet, that we had the sorriest offensive line in America, and that our coaching staff didn't have enough brains to fill up a fumble. And I want to tell you something else, Bill. He said that Baylor University academically just stunk up the place. And I tell you, Bill, I'm sick of it. I've had it up to here, this bad mouthing. I tell you, I'm going to fix that old man. You see that mule out there? And I pulled a rifle. I pulled a rifle up and slapped a slug in. No, Bill, I guess he thought I was kidding. And all of a sudden, when I pulled that slug in there and laid that rifle on the window of the car, he turned ashen white. His eyes kind of rolled back up in his head. And I just bore down on that old mule and pow! It was a fantastic shot. The old mule just dropped dead in the doornail, and I just can't bear to turn and look at Bill because he's in shock, I just know. And about the time I straightened my face up, started to turn and look at him, I heard two shots ring out. Bam, bam. I turned and looked at him. He said, I got two of his cows. Let's get the heck out of here. Loyalty. I guarantee you, man, loyalty is a vital part of life. There's no question about it. You can say what you want to about Baylor University or me, but I swear to you, don't say it around Bill Young. Just keep your mouth shut. This morning, as we talk about motivation, first of all, it is important that we clearly define what motivation is. Everybody in their own mind has a varied concept of motivation. Motivation is simply a force, either tangible or intangible, sometimes both, but a force that propels man into action. That's all motivation is. Gets you off your duck and moves you into action. That's all it is, motivation. It is a part of human life. It is the most vital part of human life because everything we do, we have to be motivated to do it. We may not even understand that we're being motivated. We may not even know it, but we are motivated in everything that we do. If I reach over to touch this microphone, it is because I am motivated to do so. There was a reason and a purpose for me doing it. Therefore, motivation is a key to success. What then is the key to motivation? Having defined it, let me try to explain it to you by giving you some examples of various methods of motivation, and there are many. The first one that I like to mention is the boss method of motivation. Yeah, the authoritarian. And there's nothing in this world wrong with that, you know. You're going to do it exactly like I tell you you're going to do it, or else. There's only one way to do it, and that's my way, and that's it. There's nothing wrong with that. All of us use it. All of us have to use it in our families, with the young people that we work with. Discipline, basic discipline, is started with authoritarian boss motivation. Hopefully, discipline will move to that where the young man is able to discipline himself, or you as an individual are able to discipline yourself. But the authoritarian method of motivation is a vital part. Last year at Baylor University, we got an awful lot of national publicity that said that Grant Taft was a great disciplinarian. Well, that's not necessarily so. The publicity came about because on a college level, we saw to it that our players were in bed at 11 o'clock every night, except before the game and, of course, earlier then. But 11 o'clock every night, they get up at 7 o'clock in the morning and they eat breakfast compulsively. Get it. That's it. No ifs, ands, and buts. That's the way it's going to be. They're going to do it that way. That's boss motivation. But there was a reason for it. There was a reason that I dictated that particular discipline. The same basic reason that you say you do not be late for this meeting. You have yourself in here 5 minutes before this meeting and you be on time. Same reason you say this is the technique I want you to use and I don't want you to vary for it. You're going to use this particular technique and no other. Same basic reason, because there's a sound, solid reason for the boss motivation. It all reverts back to goals. I'm very goal-oriented, and I'll talk a little bit more about those later. But goals are a tremendous part of life. I just couldn't get along without them, really. You know, my ultimate goal is to live to tomorrow. Well, if I'm going to live tomorrow, my immediate goal is to breathe right now. That's the simplicity of goals. Live to tomorrow, breathe right now. Immediate goals, intermediate goals, what I'm going to do 2 hours from now, and then tomorrow I'm going to be alive. That's what goals are all about. Baylor University hadn't had a winning season in 11 years, and Baylor University hadn't been in the championship in 50 years. Our goal last year was to have a winning season, and we didn't care what bowl it was, even if it was a chili bowl, we wanted to play in a bowl game. That's right. They said, we'll play in any bowl game, coach, and we'll have a winning season. That's a high and mighty goal to set, I can tell you for sure. I tell you very sure it is high because we played seven teams at one time or another that were ranked 12th or higher in the nation. We weren't supposed to win a football game. We'd lost our last seven games in 73, and we weren't supposed to win. And to have a goal of a winning season is a very lofty and high goal. We didn't say championship. I think you got to crawl before you can walk, walk before you can run. Why in the world talk about a championship when they hadn't even had a winning season in 11 years? Ridiculous. Do something you can attain, first of all, and that was to have a winning season. They set that last spring. The players did, not me. And it's very important when you're teaching goals that they set their goals and not your goals. Because if they're your goals, they're not going to attain them. Just like somebody else can't set your goals for you. You got to be the one that knows where you want to go. They set their goals having a winning season. It was almost unrealistic, but they set it. I said, okay, I believe you can do it. Now, how are we going to attain it? Well, first of all, coach, we're going to have to grow some. Everybody I weighs is 25, 35 pounds per man. We're going to have to get bigger. We're going to have to get more physical. I said, great. How are we going to do that? Well, coach, we've got a great off-season program. We've got a development running program that will help us in the spring. Then this summer, we're all going to have to work extra hard and come back in the fall in proper physical shape. And then next fall, we want to go through our weight program all the way. And we have a solid weight program that leads throughout the entire year. We gained 8 pounds from the beginning of season to the end of football season per man on our squad. We have a full-fledged weight program that goes the entire year. Instead of tailing off at the end of the season, we were getting stronger, more physical. That was part of their goal, be physical. Okay, I said, how do you do that? Well, coach, I read somewhere that rest is real important. We all ought to get in bed real early, you know, and rest. Get a rest, because, you know, dormitory, you have curfew for us 11 o'clock, and, well, it's kind of hard to get in there because somebody wants to visit a little bit, you want to study a little while, and, gosh, it ends at 1 o'clock before we ever turn out the lights, listen to Tonight Show and all those things. And so we got to dedicate ourselves, and all of us now, coach, we'll just say we're going to get in bed and get some sleep. I said, okay, that sounds good. What else? Another guy said, well, nutritionally speaking, coach, that report you showed us last year, that breakfast is the most important meal of the entire day. I said, yeah, that's right. Let's all get up and eat breakfast. We'll just all make a pack, and we'll all get up and eat breakfast. I said, yeah, that sounds good. Okay. Hogwash. 17, 18, 19-year-old young men. You say to me that you can't tell them when to be in bed. I say hogwash because you can tell them when to be in bed. You say that they're going to get in bed on their own. You're wrong. If they want the proper rest, you better see to it that they get there. So we put their tails in bed at 11 o'clock every night. It was not a dictatorial thing. They knew they had to be there. There were consequences for not being there. And one of the coaches, we alternated days, would go by the room and check them. Now, that's not just in your room. That's lights out and in bed and everything off. One of the beautiful things about it was the communication that opened up between the players and the coaches. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Then the next morning when we racked them out of that bed and they ate breakfast, one of the guys said, "But Coach," said, "I don't have a class till 10 o'clock. I said, "Tough. You get out, you eat breakfast, and you go study for 2 hours. You've been laying in that sack, sleeping through the first class till 11 o'clock. You're flunking out." We raised by 10% the average grades across our campus with the football players because of the getting to bed, getting up, and eating breakfast. They were more alert. They were stronger as the day went on, and we had better workouts and better practice because they ate the most important meal, breakfast. Simple. Boss motivation. It works. It's not the only answer, but it is a part of motivation that is most important. The second approach, I refer to it as the good old boy approach. The good old boy. You know, those kids really won out there because I'm a good old boy. They really played hard for me because I'm really a good old guy. That's fine. And I tell you what, I'm a good old guy. I really am. That's my nature to be that way. You know, I like people, and I hope people like me, and it's my nature to be good and to be a good old guy. But I tell you one thing, I'd rather have a young man's respect than have him like me. If I have his respect, then soon he'll like me. I believe that it can be a motivating factor, but I don't believe it ought to be something that you last on. I don't believe it'll sustain the good old guy theory. But if it is deeper than that, and if it has more meaning to that, then it can be a great motivational force. Let me tell you the greatest thing that was said in my behalf in 1974. And the sports writers and the coaches across the country have said some wonderful things. But the thing that meant more to me was said by one of our players about mid-season. A sports writer came up to him and said, "Listen, I want to talk to you." He said, "Fine." He said, "Listen, I want to know why game after game you all play with such determination and such dedication and with such effort and such polish. I can't understand it. Game after game after game." And the young man said to the sports writer, "Simply because Coach Taft expects it of us, and we don't want to disappoint him." Amen. That's the greatest thing that's ever been said. I have high ideals for them. They know and understand it. And they feel that I expect them to perform each and every week to the highest level of their capabilities. And if they can attain that, then I'm so grateful and so happy. But that was the finest thing I believe I've ever had said. Coach Taft expects us to do well, and we don't want to disappoint him. The third method, or approach, as we should call it, is a tricky approach. I plead guilty, not in recent years, but when I first became a head coach. As you mentioned, I was 25 years old. I thought I knew everything there was to know about coaching, and I thought the tricky method was a part of coaching. You know, I thought you ought to lie a little bit, deceit a little bit, cheat a little bit, twist the truth a little bit. Oh, you know, that old coach said you guys weren't any good, said you couldn't hit a lick at a suck egg dog. Well, you know that old coach didn't say that. You made that up. That coach is not going to say that. But those players, "Hey, that old coach said we couldn't hit a lick at a suck egg dog. Bam, get out of it." Well, let me tell you something. The tricky approach won't last. And you can't fool young men. But I tell you, there is some place for it, I guess, because I plead guilty. I used it. In 1960, 61, somewhere in there. We were playing Arlington State. This is a state school in the state of Texas. We were a little Methodist school, about 800 students. We had no business playing them. They were a big state school, but we were playing them on our homecoming game. Man, I tell you, I just love to play homecoming games. I love to win homecoming games. All of a sudden, here they were, about to play us. Saturday morning, before the game, 10 o'clock, they just finished their pregame meal, and our players were gathered in a meeting room. And I'm going over to talk to them. My last chance to tell them something great, to tell them something to think about, get ready for the football game. I start to go in this big double doors there. And just about the time I get the doors, coming around the corner, I see something. I look again, and it's a dog. It's old Ringer. An old dog that showed up about 3 years prior to this time. Old cur dog, looked like a part boxer, white. Guys, first week he was there, took some white shoe polish and painted a black ring around his eye, and they called him Ringer. Every day they feed him something out of the cafeteria. He ran through the dormitory. He'd sleep in one room tonight, the next room tonight. He was just like one of the players. There he came around the corner. He was staggering, weaving a little bit. I said, come here, boy. And Ringer came over. And Ringer was in bad shape. Ringer's left ear looked like it was just hanging by a few strands. There's a big net gash right down the middle of his black back, blood oozing out, and a big old hunk of fur right out of his hip. Looked like something just chomped it out of there. Well, old Ringer been out catting around, chasing little girl dogs, and some boyfriend or some little girl dog didn't cotton to it, and they had a doggone fight. And old Ringer didn't fare too well, and he was cut up and banged up and bleeding, looking bad. And he was looking for some sympathy. So he came over there toward me, and I reached down, patted old Ringer on the head. I said, boy, you had a bad night. And all of a sudden, tricky approach to motivation hit me. I reached down, picked old Ringer up in my arms, and gently nestled him to my chest. I walked over to those double doors, backed off, and kicked them open. And I walked into that room where those players were. There's a long table right in front of the players. And they're all startled. I walk up, lay old Ringer on the table. And Ringer did a heck of a job. Rolled his eyes back up in the head. Looked back out there. I laid old Ringer down, just right there. I looked up. I said, fellas, last night, those people from Arlington State came in here and they took old Ringer and they cut him up. Look at old Ringer. Well, I tell you one thing. I've never seen a bunch play better in my life. We kicked that Arlington State from one end of the football field to the other. Shouldn't have been within 40 points of them, and we beat them 27 points. I guarantee you it was the finest football game. I've never seen guys more highly motivated. Chena Gilstrap, the great coach from Arlington State, after the game came across to me, shook my hand, said, Coach, that was a magnificent job. I want to tell you, I've never seen guys play any better than that. What in the world? Why were they playing so wild and so vicious? I said, well, Chena, about the only thing I can say to you is this. You remember back years ago when Notre Dame used to win them for the Gipper? He said, yeah, what's that got to do with this? I said, well, just chalk this one up to old Ringer. The tricky method of motivation. I don't think it'll last, and I don't cotton to it, but I plead guilty to having used it. There is a reward approach to motivation. This is something that all of us use. Now, I can just see you in your drills out there. Coach told you not going to have any wind sprints today, so I can hear you say, all right, you guys, if you hit this time just right and do it perfect, we're not going to have any wind sprints today. You motivate them. You weren't going to have any wind sprints already, but they didn't know that. It was a tangible thing, see? I've heard the old head coach, hey, all right, man, we're going to scrimmage for 15 more minutes. You always go 25. 15 more minutes, and then if you look good, we're only going to work an hour tomorrow. You were going to only work an hour in the first place, but they didn't know that, see? So they were tangibly motivated for something. I want to tell you something. Tangible motivation is very, very important. All of us are motivated by tangible things. There's no question about it. We have to eat and sleep and drink and all of those things, and so we're motivated by it. But I want to tell you something. If that's the only thing you're motivated by, you're in a heap of trouble. You're in a heap of trouble. You're in this room today, and you're in the coaching profession for deeper reasons than that. If you're not, you won't be here 2 or 3 years from now. You will drift off into something else. But if you're motivated by deep personal commitments rather than tangible things, then you'll be here for a long, long time. It depends on what you're motivated by. Let me give you an example about tangible things. When I was a senior in college, I had a desire to have a new car when I got out of college. I wanted it so desperately, had it all picked out. I worked every night till 11 o'clock after I got out of school, after our season was over. I worked, and then all summer long I worked. I didn't have a date. I saved money because I wanted that car. And when I laid that money down and bought that car, I was the happiest guy in the world. I had been motivated by something tangible, something that I could sit in and drive and feel good. It was a wonderful feeling. But I learned something right then that has never bothered me again about motivation for material things. You see, after I'd had that car about a year, an old lady backed into me and crumpled my right rear fender. The windshield was chipped, and we had a sandstorm out there and just dented all my paint real bad, just kind of chipped it up. The old engine started leaking a little bit of oil, used a lot of gas, and the radiator went bad. And do you know that I sold that old car? That old thing didn't motivate me at all. It was a tangible thing, and there all of a sudden it was the most important thing in my life. But yet, it disappeared. It went away. To now, to this day, that old car is probably in a junkyard somewhere, you know. So therefore, I'm never motivated anymore by materialistic things. It was a great lesson. and an important lesson. Let things be of higher classification that you're motivated by. That brings me to the point that I want to make very clearly to you about my belief about motivation. I believe that motivation comes from self-motivation. Each one of us, we have a hot button somewhere. If we can find the way that we can press our own hot button and propel ourselves into action, then we can be a motivated individual. I am self-motivated. I don't have to sit around and wait for somebody else to push my hot button and move me into action. And if you do that, if you sit around and wait for your head coach or your superintendent or somebody else to press your hot button and propel you into action, you're in a heap of trouble. You better be self-motivated. And you better find out what motivates you and what turns you on. The same thing is true about working with young people. If you want to motivate them, find out what turns them on. Find out how you can teach them to press their own hot button, not you motivating. If I have to motivate a football team week after week, there's no way. You see, that football team is made up of individual men, all of them different, different concepts, different thoughts, different ideas. And if I try the same thing on each team, totally, it's not going to work. Therefore, self-motivation is the key to motivation. I was coaching at Angelo State University prior to taking the Baylor job. We had taken over a situation there. They had not won a senior college game. They had been a senior college for 5 years, a big, fine school, state school. But they had not won a game as a senior college. We took the challenge to go down there and to start a program. We recruited very well, and we only had about 18 guys left after spring training on the squad, and so we virtually started new. We lost our first ball game. We won our second ball game by a field goal. And going into our third game, we were playing the conference defending champion. Outstanding football team. And we had had some injuries and very young, and it was an awesome task and awesome responsibility for us. We played them on their home ground. We started the ball game. We played very well. We led by a score of 6-0 with 2 minutes to go in the half. Just as 2 minutes hit the clock and a half, we were forcing the opponent to punt. There was a young man standing beside me that was a senior on that ball club. He had been there at Angelo State for 4 years, hadn't won any ball games. We'd already won a game, and he was excited about the opportunity to play on a winning team. His name was Bobby Menchaca, 5'6", about 141 pounds. Bobby Menchaca was a defensive back and handled our punts. I sent Bobby into the ball game. He's standing on the 10-yard line. The punter punts. The ball is high and long. It's coming down on the 10-yard line. It looks like it's going to be over Bobby's head, and he starts to move back. He gets on about the 5-yard line, and all of a sudden he does not realize where he is. He's under instruction not to handle it inside the 10, but he's on the 5. He takes the ball, and he's hit head-on. Ball squirts out of his arms and into the end zone. They fall on it for a touchdown, kick the extra point, and halftime they lead us by a score of 7-6. We go into the dressing room, and I'm anxious to see what Bobby Menchaca will do. He goes into the dressing room, sits on the end of the bench, drops his head between his legs, and starts to cry uncontrollably. A senior in college, crying because he had lost the lead in a football game and maybe swung the momentum, but there he sat on the end of the bench crying. I didn't say a word to Bobby Menchaca, nor did any member of my coaching staff, nor did any player. Throughout the halftime, I kept one eye sort of looking at old Bobby. I wanted to see his reaction. I wanted to see what would happen to him. And about halfway through the halftime, I saw his head come up from between his legs. I could still see the tears on his cheekbones, but then I saw something that startled me. I saw a smile from ear to ear. I could not believe it. There's a guy across us leading a football game, sitting on the end of the bench, grinning. I couldn't imagine what he's doing. I didn't say anything to him. I didn't say one word to him, nor did any member of my coaching staff or any player. We left the dressing room, and I wouldn't have known to this day why the grin was on Bobby Menchaca's face, except he ran up, grabbed one of my coaches by the arm and said, "Listen, coach," said, "I'm going to run the next punt back for a touchdown. I'm going to make it up to Coach Taft. I'm going to make it up to the team. You wait and see." Coach thought he had a lick on the head. You know, you don't just say you're going to run the next punt back for a touchdown. That's ridiculous. You don't just say that. Well, we kicked off, defense held, and they punted. Bobby's standing on the 15-yard line. The ball's coming down, and they are all over it. Oh, man, I see old Bobby, and I said, "Bobby, fair catch it." He wasn't going to fair catch it. He wanted his hands on the football, and I thought a lot of old Bobby. I'd known him about a year. I liked him a lot. And so I saw that 255-pound tackle coming in on him, little 145, sitting there waiting on the ball. And I just turned my back. I didn't want to see what happened to him. Well, later I saw on the film that Bobby was literally hit head on just as he caught the football and somehow miraculously held on to it. But he was literally knocked back upfield 5 yards. Somehow he twisted and turning, hit on his feet, dropped down on his left hand, turned his feet, and came up the middle. He was hit again, spun to the right, hit again, spun to the left. By now, I've turned back around, and I'm with old Bobby. I said, hey, get in the wall, Bobby, get in the wall. Bobby wasn't interested in the wall. Bobby was interested in that goal line 85 yards down the field, twisting and turning, slashing, knifing. I've never seen a greater run in college football. We counted on the film the next day. He was hit solidly 8 times. He didn't have speed. All he had was determination and desire, and somehow he stepped across that goal line to score a touchdown on an 85-yard run. And his action so motivated the other players that we went on to win that game and went on to have the first winning season in the history of that school. Why? Because one young man was self-motivated. Oh, I'd love to take the credit for Bobby. I'd love to say, hey, I motivated that guy. Did you see what he did? I didn't say a word to him. Nobody said a word to him. Sometime in those indefinable split seconds, when he had his head down and every fiber of his being was saying, oh, you know, you made a bad mistake. Just hang your head here and, you know, they'll feel sorry for you and they'll forget it. And I know if we'd have lost the football game, I'd have walked up to Bobby and put my arm around. I said, Bobby, next time, baby, don't handle the ball in there. You're going to get it. You're great, blah, blah. But Bobby Menchaca wouldn't buy any of that, see. Instead of feeling sorry for himself, he pushed his hot button. I don't know what it was, but he pushed it. And all of a sudden, he raised his head, and there was a smile on his face of sheer confidence and determination. He knew what he was going to do. He knew how he was going to do it. Nobody else did, but he did. He was self-motivated. He took that ball in 85 yards. He stepped across the goal line. It was exactly what he had planned to do. He was motivated. He touched his hot button. And that's what we have to do. If we want to be motivated, we've got to find our own hot button and touch it.
This presentation by Baylor coach Grant Taft continues on side two. Fast forward this side to the end, then turn the cassette over to play side two. This completes side one.